This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 10th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 126th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. What's the theme of this week's show? Well, tell me this, one across, angry, something born, five letters. That'll be cross. And this, a constituent of a sentence, a contemporary greeting, four letters. You guessed it, word. This is a show in which we've fitted our letters amongst the black squares. We're all about crosswords. First, we'll meet Australia's most eminent cryptic setter, known as the Sergeant Pepper of cryptic crosswords.
It's not just the art of weaving words together. It is the art of connecting two unlikely ideas. And that is the realm of inventors and artists, I think.
We'll also speak to a professor of semiotics and anthropology to get the answers to how and why crosswords are so satisfying and addictive.
It challenges us to use our imagination, a little bit of inference, some logic, and everything is working in tandem until you say, aha, I've got it.
And we'll investigate the strange and combative world of competitive crossword solving in the United States.
We're all nerding out about crosswords and these crosswords in particular, which are usually some of the best ones that we see all year.
Plus, we'll speak to one of Monocle 24's own newsreaders and crossword devotees, Barney Burnham. We'll ask how these word puzzles translate in Japan. And if your mind's in a boggle, fear not. The very talented Esco will be on hand to calm your worries in this week's Midori House session, which has absolutely nothing to do with fitting letters into boxes and just swings. So grab the nearest newspaper, find yourself a pen and prepare yourself for a mental workout. All here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Business as usual to begin with, though, we'll take a track from this week's Midori House session. Eska is a British singer-songwriter who we kind of think has soul and spirit running through her veins. She's new with only an EP to her name at the moment called The Gatekeeper. From it, here she is with the title track.
Gatekeeper, where there's no wise leader, there'll be no brighter, lighter, but you keep letting it in, let it in, let it, let it in, let it, let it in, gatekeeper. Here is your reminder. There is a kinder teacher. But will you let him in? Let him in, let him, let him in, let him, let him in. Don't you go listening to that voice, like a city without a wall. You are open to anything. See, flirting in the danger zone, trying to be all things to all men. Won't you take your stand when you get? Haven't learned just when you feel it bad. Pride up, but you get too fired up. Still taking fight up. Gonna get to you, get fired on a cylinder's yeah.
That was the delightful Eska singing Gatekeeper, and she'll be providing the musical interludes for our puzzle playground throughout the show. This week, we're investigating that most popular of puzzles, that which is, for many people, as crucial as their morning ablutions, that which is said to sharpen the synapses, but also can lead many a newspaper reader to throw down their Times in disgust. It's often said that a newspaper editor can change whatever they want about the front or the back page, but it's at their peril that they mess with the cryptic crossword. These tormenting puzzles have now been a mainstay of printed media for 100 years. The first crossword appeared in the New York World on the 21st of December 1913, set by Arthur Wynne, a Brit who left for New York to take up journalism. A new book, Cluetopia, is written by the Australian crossword setter David Astle, whose work appears in the Melbourne Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. He's a favourite of linguists throughout the Red Country. Geoffrey Rush has even called him the Sergeant Pepper of cryptic crosswords. To kick off our crosswords special then, Monocle's Adrian Craddock visited David to explore how he acquired his peculiar skill set and asked the question, can puzzles be art?
I do remember growing up and seeing weird things in letters, even as a kid. And in fact, there was this really big billboard I remember as a child. I would have been about maybe 3 or 4. And it was for a butcher's shop. And it was on the road to my grandmother's house. And we'd always go past it every second week. And it said, pleased to meet you, meet to please you. And I thought, you know what? That, in a way, is permission to embrace riddles, enjoy double entendres, to muck around with letters, because clearly there's some avenue out there for grown-ups to muck around with words and letters as well.
As far as channeling this fascination with words into the skill of compiling crosswords or setting crosswords, how did that journey start? I mean, you had a mentor, didn't you?
I did. In fact, my tormentor, a guy called Lindsay Brown, better known as LB in Australia, he was the don of crosswords in Australia for about 30 years. He was pretty much the sole creator of cryptics in both the Telegraph and the Sydney Morning Herald, which is a phenomenal feat. And eventually when I met him, it was very exciting because I felt as though I'd already met him in person through his clues. And to meet him actually in person, sitting in his kitchen with all these dictionaries surrounding him instead of cookbooks, and a farting bulldog at his feet called Monty, I suddenly realised that he was my future because I so desperately wished to occupy that chair. And eventually I did. And I haven't regretted it because it has been a real joy to be able to divert all this mania in my head into the joy and purity of crosswords.
When you say you felt like you'd already met him, I mean, what do you mean?
The wordplay may take the form of anagrams or spoonerisms or homophones. There's about 8 different recipes. And really it is the combination of these weird recipes clicked in to the dictionary side of the clue that reflects the sort of person you are, the sort of humour you have, the kind of politics you carry, the heroes you admire and the villains that you despise, that all just starts to filter through. So I know, as a kid solving LB's crosswords, that he loved cricket, that he loved classical music, that he hated charlatans, that he was not a fan of Labour politics. And all that came, you know, just kind of in a slow drip feed through his subterfuges.
Do you have an example of one clue that really does expose the kind of person that you are in some way?
For example, there was a theme that I did that was all about global warming. That was the central entry. And what you had to do was within words such as, let's say, cold, which starts with C and C is cold, you had to change cold to hot because the whole idea was the puzzle was getting hotter. So when you came across a word like cod, that had to turn into hod. And when you came across coward, that turned into Howard. And really, I deliberately chose Howard in that crossword because not only do I think global warming is a genuine problem that we need to address, but also Howard is part of that coalition tradition that has been hiding from that truth. Being a cryptic crossword, you can tend to get away with more radical politics in a paper than you ever can in a column or an op-ed piece.
You've just released a book kind of chronicles the last 100 years of crossword and cryptic crossword making. I mean, what did your research in that book reveal?
I looked at crosswords right across the world, and the same ideas apply even in the Swedish examples. The Swedes have beautiful visual puns. I'll give you an example. There was a monkey dressed up as Sherlock Holmes, and that was a primate detective, not private, but primate. While that may seem to be a dad joke, it's also having a real piece of fun at the expense of language and sort of social mores and zeitgeists. It's just beautiful fun.
Looking over that 100-year history, is it fair to say that cryptic crosswords are still going strong? You know, they're as strong as ever? Or have, you know, other popular puzzles like Sudoku kind of dented its popularity?
Things like Sudoku do bring more people to the puzzle page, and it does always delight the more logical thinker. But when it comes to the evolution of crosswords in general and cryptics in particular, it's jaw-dropping to see what's occurred in the last 15 years. And to give you an example, we've had crosswords in the New York Times that have alternative answers. It was an incredible piece of work in 1996 by Jeremiah Farrell that could accommodate both Bob Dole or Clinton as winning the election, depending upon who actually won it. Even last year, where we had a haunting moment of Reverend John Graham for The Guardian actually announcing his own imminent death through a crossword, declaring his condition, he had esophageal cancer, talking about his sunset and his reign as a crossword maker, and finishing with the word merriment. So it was a very personal document, essentially an intimation about his own mortality.
It sounds like the real meccas are still places like the New York Times and the Times in England. Where does Australia fit into that puzzle?
I think that Australia for a long time has been the poor cousin and probably perceived as being just a place where syndicated puzzles end up, that is, puzzles that are imported. But thanks to the pioneering work of LB, a new wave of crossword makers that is just starting to pick up momentum at the moment. There's this enormous conversation and support that's happening for crosswords.
And would you say that Australian crossword setters have any particular characteristics? I mean, is there a particular Australian flavour to cryptic crosswords in this country?
I'll choose an Australianism. For example, I might choose Occy strap, you know, rather than saying octopus strap. So there right away is a sort of the ochreism of Occy. It's often the content or the slight bent that I've given the wordplay, which does betray my nationality.
Well, that was great, wasn't it? That was crossword setter David Astle talking to Adrian Craddock in Melbourne. We might well say that we're one down. If For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, a crossword special today. We just heard how you write a crossword, but when it comes to the cryptic clues, how on earth do you solve them? Well, in a bid to understand why the back pages of many of Monocle's daily newspapers have been ripped and cut about practically since the launch of our radio station, we felt that perhaps Monocle newsreader Barney Burnham could offer an explanation. He is an inveterate crossword fan, after all. What's the attraction, Barney?
Right, let's have a look at this then. What looks easy? A four-letter one, six across, something worn in Amritsar, India. Well, if you run Amritsar into India, you get S-A-R-I. That's something worn there, so that's that one done. Four, river bottom as place for experimental trials. Two words, four and three. Trials, well, that's often test, isn't it? And test, that is a river in Hampshire, I believe. So, well, that's test, and then what? River bottom, well, place for experimental bottom bed. Experimental trials, test bed. I like this one. Frame badly and hang. I would say the best way to get inside the head of crossword setters is look at a completed solution and work your way back from the answer to the clue. And often it will make sense. Often it won't.
This is sometimes like interviewing people where they give you those answers and you have to form a question around it.
Well, often I will reach a solution which is the only possible solution on the letters available. But I don't know how I've got there. Take the Times. The Times is a bit more difficult. I mean, I'm on a hot streak at the moment and this one took about 20 minutes this morning.
Right.
Sometimes I'll take it home with me and there are certain clues that I'm tearing my few remaining hairs out of my head. I get home, have a cup of tea, sit down, bang, 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 bang. What was the problem with that?
Do you have to be in a certain frame of mind to be able to do this?
Possibly, but what I would say is that I very rarely do crosswords other than at the beginning of the day. I mean, quite possibly, if I were to pick a blank crossword up tonight, which was as easy as the ones that I've done today, I'd struggle with them.
I guess your brain's conditioned to do it. Your brain is used to do it and expecting it in the morning, right?
Yes, and also you're used to certain setters because they vary them. And sometimes if they change a setter on a particular day, you know, whereas the last week you've gone through them like a dose of salt, suddenly you're struggling. You think, how can I even start this? The great detective series, Inspector Morse, he never revealed his name until very close to the end of the series, and he finally was persuaded to give a clue towards it. My whole life's effort revolved around Eve.
So let's revolved, talk this one through.
That clearly tells you that that's rearranging the letters, doesn't it? And
okay.
Revolved around Eve. And around Eve, if you revolve them, it gives you Endeavour. And his parents named him Endeavour because they were Quakers and great admirers of Captain Cook.
Because I'm not used to doing a cryptic crossword, I'm thinking of the Garden of Eden, Adam, well, who would revolve around Eve? And I'm thinking very literally
words
about
like
it.
Like revolved, scattered, badly, crookedly, all things, they all tell you anagram.
Okay.
But also don't read things literally, because take this one here, tell, for example, leaders of striking workers if stoppage is suspended. And you think, tell the unions, scabs, pickets. But then tell, for example, leaders of, yes, the first letters of striking workers if stoppage is suspended, S-W-I-S-S, Swiss. Tell, William Tell, the most famous Swiss person in history or mythology, whichever you believe. A lot of these expert cruciverbalists, to give them their correct title, are probably fairly geeky. Horribly, I'm pointing the finger at myself here. I'm very like Inspector Morse. I'm a cruciverbalist. I'm an opera-loving real ale drinker.
There we go, Barney. Let me ask you, though. It's often written that people get into the head of the people that set these crosswords. Would you want to go for a pint of hogsback tea? That's a famous real ale here in the UK, with any of the people that set these crosswords.
Well, Years ago, I was producing a radio programme at a London station, and we came across the idea of having a crossword setter in. We thought it might be interesting. And I rang around various newspapers, and they put somebody up. And this particular person was indescribably boring. So does that answer your question?
Right, OK. Sometimes it's better to drink alone than with a crossword setter.
It can be, yes.
Give us one last one. There's a Fresh Times crossword from today here. Let's take 14 down, Barney, on here.
14 down, security device, the point of which isn't clear when it works, and it's a hyphenated word, 6 letters and 3 letters. Well, security, safety, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And what comes after safety? Safety pin. And the answer to that is, the point of which isn't clear when it works. Well, when you shut a safety pin, you don't see the point of it.
And that was Monocle's resident crossword fanatic, Barney Burnham, putting my brain to shame there. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And if you thought Barney was a bit quirky, we're talking competitive crossword championships next.
Long the unsung hero of Italian manufacturing, it's high time Naples told some of its sunnier stories from the factory floor. So Monocle Films headed south to explore the workshops and the studios around the city's famous bay.
Back streets and backyards teem with the tinkering and tapping of thousands of expert makers. From coffee to umbrellas, and from yachts to chocolates, you don't have to be in Naples long to see a city with an uncanny knack for making things.
Made in Naples, discovering a city that makes a whole lot more than pizza. Premiering in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This is a special show dedicated to the art and fascinating world of the crossword. Daniel Feyer is one of the fastest crossword puzzle solvers in the world. The musician works on about 20 puzzles a day and has more than 100,000 of them saved on his computer. He won the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament in 2013, 2012, 2011 and 2010. This year's tournament has just taken place and yet again, Daniel took top place. Pauline Eifman caught up with him in New York to see how he was preparing and just exactly how he does it.
I use the first puzzle to calm my nerves a little bit. When you finish the puzzle, you'll check the clock first thing. The scoring is done by minute, so if you finish the puzzle and you've got 40 seconds left in the minute, you'll use that 40 seconds to check your grid, make sure there's no empty squares. That was a mistake I made one year. I feel like I have to just keep it up and not make a mistake. I don't want to try too hard, I don't want to race too fast. We're all nerding out about crosswords, and these crosswords in particular, which are usually the best ones, some of the best ones that we see all year.
On your mark, get set, go.
I always did puzzles when I was a kid, but I wouldn't call myself a puzzle person. I started doing the Sunday New York Times crossword in college when I got my hands on the Times magazine. I would help my aunt solve the Sunday puzzle because she liked to do that. I didn't really get into puzzles seriously until I saw the movie Wordplay.
A dramatic come-from-behind last-second victory. Ellen is the winner. Hollywood couldn't have scripted a better finish.
I found out that the crossword tournament was going to be in Brooklyn that year for the first time. And since I lived in New York and I had that weekend free, I thought, oh, I like to do crosswords. Maybe I will check it out. And in the few months leading up to that first tournament, I got hooked. I started downloading all of the crosswords online that I could. I bought a whole bunch of puzzle books. I bought a book of past tournament puzzles and started solving those, and I did pretty well the first time, and by that point, I was totally addicted. I started doing probably 20 to 25 puzzles per day on average, and I was getting faster very quickly. Over the next couple of years, I worked my way up to the top of the standings.
So you actually got interested in crossword puzzles seriously because of the tournament. Can you describe what the atmosphere is like during a competition like that?
There's 600 people in a room. sitting at long tables, all solving the same puzzle. So it's very quiet. And slowly people finish and start walking out of the room and going out into the hallway and talking about how fast we all did that puzzle and whether we all made a mistake. Checking if there are any questionable crossings, we will compare notes and see if we all got it correct. The people that come to a crossword tournament are all very interested in words, so they're interesting people from all walks of life. It's a surprisingly friendly group, especially among the top competitors. We're all friends. We're not really rivals, and we support each other. We're happy whoever comes away with the title, I think.
You mentioned that you do 20 to 25 puzzles a day. What else do you get when you compete? Why compete?
Well, at this point, I'm showing up because I have a chance at winning a cash prize. The reason a lot of people show up is not because they're trying to win a prize, but because it's the main meeting place. It's the main convention for crossword fans around the country and around North America.
So you flew in from San Francisco this morning to compete. Is there any way you're preparing for this weekend?
I've been doing more puzzles in the last couple of weeks than I usually do. I've printed out a bunch of extra puzzles from the archives of the New York Times. I've gotten a couple of books to work through, and all of the daily puzzles that I would usually do on my computer, I'm printing out and doing on paper because that's how the tournament is run. It's all pencil and paper.
What is the difference?
I'm faster solving on the computer than on paper, and I don't have to print it out, waste paper and ink, and I can do it faster when I'm typing than writing. So for most of the year, I'll do the Times and all the other puzzles on my computer on a program called Across Light. But for the last month or two before the tournament, increasingly I will print them out and do them on paper so that I can practice having my eye go to the right place. The hardest part about solving on paper is looking in the right place. I'm looking at 24 across, my eye has to go to the clue for 24 across and find it immediately in the list and then go back. So it's jumping back and forth between writing in the grid and finding the right clues. And I've usually got more than one clue in my head at the same time. I'm trying to write constantly and look here, there, up and down at the right clue. So getting into that groove is the most important thing I can do before the tournament so that I don't waste precious seconds trying to find a clue.
And would you consider competing internationally?
No. If people call me the world champion at crosswords, I have to correct them because I can't beat Englishmen at a British-style crossword, which are a different style. Those are what we call cryptic crosswords in America. And I'm decent at those, but I can't do the crosswords in The Guardian, for instance, which, you know, a Brit can knock off in 15 minutes if they're good. And I don't speak any other languages, so I can't do French crosswords or Italian crosswords or Japanese crosswords. Almost every language has a style of crosswords. It's popular all around the world, but I can't do any of them except for American crosswords.
Nine-letter word for cocktail with a cherry. 15-letter word for resistant to moisture, say.
That was US crossword puzzle champion Daniel Lafayette speaking to Pauline Eifman in New York. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of this week's Midori House session from Esker. We'll continue our crossword theme, discussing whether the thirst for puzzles is more ancient than we might think, and we'll ask how well the crossword translates into Japanese. One word, 11 letters, the clue, all of the above. Fascinating. Time for some more music now, as balm to the brow, furrowed by wordplay. We'll hear a little bit more about her in a moment, but first, from this week's Midori House session, here's Esker with To Be Remembered.
London, you walked me through your garden, and you showed me those trees you planted forever. every love that you had. How we all would love to be remembered. We all would love to be remembered. Well, I texted you on my journey. What tree would you plant for me? You wrote back, it'd be a weeping willow. A melancholy tree, but the roots grow deep underneath. Baker's boy, she's a heavy feeder.
Seem to mix soul and a bit of jazz and spirituals as well. Maybe it's your voice or it's the cadence of those songs. Do you care what people call your music? Are you a bit of a genre snob, or do you just consider all music to be the same?
Duke Ellington said there's only two types of music. There's good music and the other. That's
yeah, right.
So, as far as I'm concerned, those are the two genres that I, you know, well, I'm not aiming for the other one, but
What about how do these songs, where do these songs arrive? Where do they come from?
The funny thing is, I don't really consider myself to be an instrumentalist apart from, you know, my voice is my principal yeah. instrument. Any other instrument that I pick up in order to induce the song.
Right. Okay.
As it were, you know, evoke the song. Yeah. And because tones and textures and timbres, all those things make me think of melodies. They make me think visually and then can inspire lyrics and melodies. And that's at the core what I'm looking for. You know, it's only fairly recently that I resolved that in myself. You can give yourself a hard time, you know, I wish you'd practice more and all of that. But actually, my principal aim for playing music is to write. And so in finding a new instrument or learning a new instrument or hearing a new sound, if it's an in to lyricism and melodies, then I'm a very happy, you know.
The hallowed corridors of the conservatoire. Tell us about that.
I'm very grateful for being in a disciplined environment of a conservatoire. It was at Blackheath Conservatoire in Southeast London, where I got a scholarship when I was 12. And I have to say, you know, they were obsessed with their instrument. They were obsessed. Right. They didn't care that I had homework. They didn't care I had a life outside of playing violin or whatever it was. They were obsessed with this thing and you working as hard as you can to be great at this thing. It was sometimes quite confusing and quite scary and daunting.
What's the teaching like? Is it kind of what I might consider kind of old fashioned? You learn it until you do it right. You're not leaving the room until, or is it, how is it done? Did they draw it out of you, or do they kind of hammer it home to you, I wonder? Or what was it like for you?
I don't know if I can speak for the whole conservatory, you know, for Blackheath Conservatoire, yeah. My violin teacher, Ruth Davis, she was a phenomenal woman who, she was pretty much, you stand there until you get it right. Okay. She was one of those. I mean, I remember one of my lessons where pretty much half of it was spent tuning my violin. I'll never forget that lesson as long as I live, because I remember starting to play and I thought, I tuned up and then I started to play the piece. And then she said, stop, you know, you need to tune up. So I started walking to the piano and she said, what are you doing? And I said, I need to get an A. And she said, no, you don't. And I said, oh, looked at her quite confused and said, you know what an A is. And I thought, in my head, I'm going, I don't know what an A is. This woman's crazy. What is she talking about? I thought, well, God, I'm not going to argue with her. And I'm kind of going, I'm trying to find an A. And then she said, that's not an A. And then I'll try and find again and tune it again. Nope. And it kept going on like that for what seemed like an eternity until, you know, and then eventually said, yes, that's an A. You know what an A is. And I've never forgotten what an A is ever since.
I guess that's the thing.
I'm not saying that that necessarily, that kind of austere method is right for everybody, but it was inspiring for me, I have to say.
I wanted to ask you where all this is going. I know you write a very candid blog about making an album, right?
Yes.
Where are we at with that now?
Well, yeah, I'm actually going to be getting back on the blogging and actually changing to vlogging and sort of making a bit of a video diary of the next few weeks leading up to the album release, which is in May, June. I don't have a specific date as yet, but I do have a private listening party that's happening next week, which I'm delighted to be sharing the album with a group of people that had contributed to the crowdfunding that I did in order to release my self-release, the EP, the Gatekeeper EP, which came out last November. And this self-titled album will be out around the same time as I'll be touring the UK in May, and then June I'll be going to America to perform out there and then coming back for some festival dates in the UK again.
That was Eska, whose EP Gatekeeper is out now, and she's playing a few dates across the UK this spring too. EskaOnline.com is where you can find out more. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Right, back to this week's theme. I'll give you a clue what it is. A clue, see? What else would it be? We're investigating the world of crossword puzzles. We've covered the history, how you set, how you solve them, and we've had a breather. But what about the science? You might have heard that crosswords are meant to be good for the grey matter. So who better to explain just what they do and why they're addictive than a crossword-loving professor? Marcel Danese, Professor of Semiotics and Anthropology from the University of Toronto, has conducted extensive research on puzzles and has written a number of scholarly books on puzzles, semiotics, linguistic and pedagogical topics. How's that for a CV?
My mother, who had no education, an immigrant from a village in northern Italy, living here in Toronto, she would do crosswords religiously every day, an Italian magazine. And I know she was addicted to them because there were times when we didn't have dinner because she just forgot to make it. My mother became so eloquent and so argumentative, and this is someone who had maybe a grade 2 or grade 3 training, that many years later I decided that as an anthropologist, I got to get to the bottom of this. Why is it that words displayed in a grid based on clues, which may or may not, some of them make sense, but they're really designed to get you to put them in this spot. So it's a placement thing. And I said to myself, why do we do this and why is it good for us? The answers could be a short one and simply say that by exercising your linguistic parts of the brain, you're doing a good thing for the brain. Or it could be a more elaborate one. And I'm going to try to shorten the elaborate one because I think it's insightful. When you have in front of you an empty grid like that, it stands out and you feel a kind of void or emptiness inside of you. By starting to fill it logically and with the clues and the information that's required, when it's all completed, the sense of satisfaction that comes from it is its own reward. And I call this a puzzle instinct. We need this. I used to know one person here in North Toronto who would do jigsaw puzzles. I mean, really elaborate jigsaw puzzles, some of them 1,000 pieces. When he had finished, he would glue the pieces together and then put them in a painting on his wall. And God help if anybody tried to destroy those crossword puzzles. He said, I achieved it. This is me. In other words, why I think they're so good for us is because it involves us with the artifact, with the text itself. It challenges us to use our imagination, a little bit of inference, some logic, and everything is working in tandem until you say, aha, I've got it. Now, there are times when you can't solve it. So our strategies are interesting because frustration can evolve. You can either throw the puzzle away and say, I'll never do this again. I met people who do that. I hate puzzles. What they usually says is that I haven't got the patience or the time to go through them. You do not need intelligence to solve puzzles. You need patience. You need trial and error. And you have to go back and forth. You have to engage yourself totally in them. But boy, when you're done, the satisfaction is incomparable.
Indeed. I guess the addictive element to it is built into this idea that we're using the brain and we're being rewarded when we see those white squares fill up with letters. That is, we get the reward, the satisfaction. So they become addictive because of that. But I wondered, Marcel, whether we use the same part of the brain that uses facility of language to do crosswords, or whether it's the same thing, whether we're filling out a Sudoku or a crossword, whether it's numbers or letters, we're actually using our ability to build patterns and inferences between them in the same way.
Yes. And when you do that, it's the whole brain that's involved, not just a part of it. Although the left hemisphere is renowned or known for being the linguistic hemisphere, certainly the more imaginative part, you mentioned the word inference. The instant you infer something, you've got all kinds of things clicking up in the brain somewhere. Because it's by blending ideas, associating them, sometimes they're obscure, finding a twist, finding a pattern. Once you get it, you see, and the metaphor is a good one, the path towards the solution, then the rest is ho-hum, okay, I'm going to get there. It's like a mystery story, like a detective story. And in fact, in the origins of the puzzles, the riddles of the ancient world, they grew out of mystery cults, out of philosophical debates, in order to test our human imagination.
Do we feel that people that are good at crosswords are better at communication? I know you're a professor of semiotics and also of communication theory. Do puzzles and crosswords in particular, they help us communicate with others?
You know, I'm a little wary of saying that puzzles help anything. I mean, music helps, reading helps, everything helps. What you're probably asking me, and I'm asked this a lot, is do they have any particular qualities that enhance communication, cognition, and other things? At first, I was skeptical, but over the years, I'm beginning to believe, and I'm reading some of the research that comes out in the technical literature, that indeed there is a correlation between enhanced cognitive and communicative skills, and doing things like riddles and other puzzles. But here's the trick. You got to start early in life, number one. And number two, it has to be an eclectic mix of puzzles. If you're just a Sudoku fanatic, it's good. I mean, I welcome it, but it's best that you add to it other genres of puzzles in order to fill out the whole spectrum of neurological activity that they entail. It's not a magic pill to say, look, you do this and you're going to be a better communicator. I don't think so. It's a kind of lifestyle, a mental lifestyle that you're engaged in. And if so, if it does work, then I think the ultimate outcomes are marvelous. Among other things, you'll feel better about yourself, if nothing else.
What's your workout? Your book is The Total Brain Workout, and that's 450 puzzles to sharpen up your synapses, Marcel. What's your workout every day? Maybe let's talk us through your morning mental workout.
Well, I actually create puzzles for the daily newspaper here called the Toronto Star. Mm-hmm. And I create puzzles for a blog I have, psychology. So I actually create them. Now, here's the paradox. I'm better at creating them than at solving them. Because I know where the twist is. I know where the pattern is that I've hidden. Whereas I'm not so sure I know where it is when someone else creates it. So in a way, you're in a dialogue, a kind of anonymous dialogue with your potential solver. And I have to tell you that I receive emails some of the time, usually angry ones. He said, come on, that wasn't fair. You should not have done that to us. So there is an emotional component to it.
Professor Marcel Danesi from the University of Toronto there, and his new book, The Total Brain Workout, will be published later this year by Harlequin. You're listening to a crossword special of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Next, we'll ask how crosswords work when you're not using the English alphabet.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Culture, where this week's show is all about the fascinating world of the crossword. Well, as we heard earlier, the crossword was first published in a newspaper in New York in 1913, and the breakaway cryptic movement began in London around a decade later. Since then, they spread around the globe. But how do they work in places that don't use English or the Latin alphabet? I caught up with Kenji Hall from our Tokyo bureau to talk crosswords Japan style.
Typically, when Japanese crosswords, the boxes themselves are smaller. And this is because the words are actually shorter. They're usually 2 to 5 boxes total. But that's because of the characteristics of the language itself. Japan's alphabet uses syllables rather than letters. So for crossword puzzles, you would enter a character representing a syllable. For instance, ta instead of a T, or mu instead of just an M.
So how does that work with the clues? When you read a Japanese crossword, you're almost reading sounds on a page that make words, am I right?
No, actually, the clues are exactly the same as they would be in an English language crossword puzzle.
Uh-huh.
So for instance, I have one sitting in front of me from the very latest Shukan Asahi, which is a mainstream news weekly. And they'll ask you anything from general knowledge, like what is the prefecture with the most Shinkansen stations, to things like what would you put into a tire? Obviously, air or kuki in Japanese.
Uh-huh.
So it can be general knowledge. It can also be tricky. There's one that I can't quite figure out. It says something you pull. There are lots of words packed into this one. So
wow.
Some of it is very, very cultural, and the cultural references are lost on me.
We spoke yesterday to one of our newsreaders here at Monocle 24, who's a massive crossword fan and always rips the back pages off all the broadsheet newspapers, much to the chagrin of all our sports lovers here in the office. But he's going for the cryptic crossword. That's where they sit in British newspapers, for example. It'd be nice to know how it works in Japanese newspapers. Does the Yomiuri Shimbun, for example, and the big daily broadsheets, do they have a crossword every day, or is it less common?
It's actually less common. It's generally once a week, and it alternates between the mainstream newspapers. So, for instance, the Yomiuri newspaper would have its crossword on a Sunday. The Asahi would have its crossword on a Saturday. And there's a reason for this. They do a rotation of different types of puzzles. So one day it might be Sudoku. Another day it might be a different type of puzzle. And then another day would be a crossword puzzle. But all of these puzzles come from the same company. There's one company that's responsible for nearly all puzzles that you see in any of the sports newspapers or weekly magazines or mainstream newspapers. It's a company called Nikoli. And here in Japan, Nikoli is a household name because it's the self-proclaimed inventor of Sudoku.
Uh-huh.
And it's a major publisher of things like puzzle magazines, books, logic games, and brain teasers. So, you know, this company is so prolific that some puzzle fans will call themselves Nikolists.
Broadly speaking, does it seem that number games are more popular in Japan and in Asia than word games? Do you see people feverishly on the commuter trains, for example, filling out their crosswords, or are they more into the Sudoku?
Well, just like in the West, I think Sudoku was extremely popular at one point. The pendulum has sort of swung the other way. These days, you're seeing more word games. There are all types of games. There's one where it just has the Chinese characters called kanji all over in what appears to be a crossword puzzle grid. And you're supposed to find the path from one side of the grid to the other side of the grid. I mean, there are all sorts of variations on the crossword puzzle. Some of them are direct derivations of the crossword. Some of them are not. Just a little history here. The first crossword puzzle appeared in the Sunday Mainichi, which is one of these mainstream weekly news magazines, back in 1925. So the history, there's actually a good deal of history mm-hmm. behind the crossword puzzles here. There are a couple of rules, too, when it comes to creating crossword puzzles. Generally, they only use nouns. Now, I asked why, and I was told that because if you used verbs and other things that you could conjugate, it would get far too complex. Now, given the complexity of the characters in Japanese, I would assume that that's what they're talking about.
I'm getting the feeling that in Japanese newspapers, crosswords are maybe saved more for weekend, maybe more for downtime and leisure time. Are puzzles in the big newspapers on a daily basis, or do they tend to be saved for Saturday and Sunday editions?
Yomiuri and Asahi, which are the two biggest of the mainstream papers, they run theirs on weekends.
Uh-huh.
So that would suggest that, you know, most people do them on the weekends. You don't generally see people doing these things on the trains. More often you'll see them staring at their smartphones or doing a Sudoku puzzle. So, you know, I would assume that the biggest fan base is really the elderly and the hardcore puzzlists who also contribute ideas to Nikoli for new games.
Our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall there, and that brings us to the end of this crossword special here on Culture. Next week, we'll be back to our usual tricks, catching up on all the events we've missed, the Armory Show in New York, the Adelaide Festival, and much more. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilbao, who wanted to thank You Know Who by attempting to turn her into a cryptic clue. She came up with spike in Christmas sales leads to fruitful semen. God knows what Holly Fisher will make of that. Time for one final song this week. The phenomenal Eska is here to see us out. Go and download her EP Gatekeeper. It's a corker. From it, this is She's in the Flowers. Thanks for tuning in.
Slipped underground, hers was a battle that laid her to rest. And when her body returned to the land, seeds of a memory grew up from the earth. She's been gone a long, long time. It's all right, now she's in the flowers. Queen of the shade. Seasons turn though his memory fades. She is the bloom that he grips in his hand. Who knew the boy but did not know the man? She knew the boy but did not see the man. Ah, she's been gone a long, long time. It's all right now, she's in the flowers, yeah. Says, I wonder if you'd be proud of the man that I've become. I wonder if you were with me now. Oh, she's been gone a long, long time. It's all right now, she's in the flowers. It's all right. She's in the flowers.